I thought we'd talk tonight about rebirth, so I called the talk Whatever Next. A 44-year-old Scots-born Canadian singer called Sherry Lee Laird has made an interesting discovery. She believes she's the reincarnation of no less than Marilyn Monroe. Yes, that Marilyn Monroe. Apparently, Sherry was born exactly 9 months after Marilyn died in 1962 in somewhat mysterious circumstances. Now, from childhood on, into her 30s, Sherry would regularly experience crushing chest pains and would experience disgusting, vile feelings of shame and remorse. Now, these would be in sort of like 20-minute periods, and then they'd stop. Also, as she grew older, she started to experience flashbacks back to the 50s, including one, a really great one, where she's sitting really close to Frank Sinatra as he's singing in a club. Well, who wouldn't want that? Also, other famous 50s names, Arthur Miller, Joe DiMaggio, and the Kennedy brothers, no less. She'd experience these in flashbacks. Now, in the 30s, her early 30s, just like Marilyn, she began to feel suicidal, and even attempted a couple of times to take her own life, overdosing on pills. Now, at the age of 35, at the same age Marilyn actually died, Sherry decided that she needed to get help. And she approached a top American psychiatrist called Adrian Finkelstein for help, and she agreed to take part in regression therapy. Now, as a result of the regression therapy that she went through, she came to believe, and so did her psychiatrist, that these episodes, these 20-minute episodes, were, she had actually been reliving Marilyn's death experience. Now, according to Sherry, she believed that Marilyn Monroe did take her own life. But even as she was there dying of an overdose, she actually regretted it, deeply regretted it. She realized that this was a wrong thing to do, it was a mistake. Now, Dr. Finkelstein came to believe that she was indeed the reincarnation of Marilyn too. He said, "I was skeptical because I'm a scientist. But the more evidence I gathered, the harder it was to disbelieve. Not only are there physical similarities between Sherry and Marilyn, the details she was able to provide under regression were just phenomenal." And he points out her ability to answer hundreds of detailed questions about Marilyn's life under hypnosis. Apparently, she could even pick out Marilyn's maternal aunts in photographs. The good news, and it's always good to end on some good news, since undertaking regression therapy and exploring every aspect of Marilyn's life, Sherry no longer experiences those death pains, those death experiences. Now, Sherry firmly believes that what she calls reincarnation is all about learning from and overcoming past mistakes. Now, what kind of reaction do people get to hearing that kind of story? The whole question of life and death is, of course, deep, to say the very least. There are some who just do not want to discuss it, and any mention of it is considered to be a social faux pas. There are some that hold very strongly to the view that there is only one life. They tend to be rational, logical, scientific, materially minded people. There are also those who believe that there is within the body a soul that transmigrates and moves from life to life. There are some who believe that this is just one life, and then afterwards there's either eternal damnation or eternal heaven, depending on what views you hold. So there are some who take the view that it's completely irrational, illogical, and To believe it, well, reincarnation, rebirth, you'd have to be crazy. There are others, Voltaire for one, who would say, is it any more irrational to be born twice than it is to be born at all? Now, the purpose of tonight's talk is to just talk a little bit about the Buddhist view of rebirth in context of all these different views, and just to explore why the doctrine of rebirth is there and why it's so important to remain open-minded, especially if you want the fruits from your practice. So really, we've got to, first of all, we've got to look at the evidence. What evidence can we turn to try and judge the validity of the rebirth view? Science is the predominant, you'd say it was the predominant view in the West, and probably all over the world now. And yet, what scientific proof can we look to back up either the one life view or the many life view? I did a little bit of research and I couldn't find anything. I think the problem is that scientific probes just cannot go there. Scientific probes just cannot go beyond life. They're something to be used in the material world. If there is anything beyond the material, if there's anything beyond mind and body in this life, shall we say, then scientific investigation will just not turn up anything. So there's no evidence to suppose that there's one life, and there's no scientific evidence to suppose there's more than one life, which is kind of handy, really, because then you can sort of just put it to one side. That's not to say that science doesn't have its value, of course it does, but in just this one particular area, it doesn't really seem to be its domain, if I can put it like that. So what other kinds of evidence might there be? There's circumstantial evidence. You get reports, for instance, of children remembering past lives. Dr. Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia, for instance, has spent his entire, pretty much his entire working life collating, scientifically researching these reports. So that means going to meet the actual child, hearing what the child has to say about remembering past lives. If it's the case that the child remembers where they lived in that past life and what the names of their family were, what they did for a living and that sort of thing, then Stevenson would actually go and check all this out, and he would log it all scientifically. And we do have books in the library if anyone's interested. So there is circumstantial evidence to suppose more than one life. It's these children being able to remember their past lives and being able to give facts and figures that can then be verified. Now, as we go on for evidence, it begins to become more subjective, a lot more subjective. Sherry Lee Laird, for instance, clearly she had memories and flashbacks, but she was also regressed, hypnotized. What other ways are there? A notable way is near-death experiences. This is where somebody may have an incident, perhaps an accident, car accident, something like that, and for a time they actually report afterwards when they come back round that they left their body, and that they may have an experience of that sort of thing, going through a tunnel towards some light, and then perhaps some family members or a religious figure that they recognize appears and welcomes them. They have a quick chat. It's suggested that this isn't the time, they should now go back. Again, very subjective, but for the people involved, it changes their life. In the vast majority of cases of people who have near-death experiences, they become more spiritual in outlook, and they do lose a lot of their fear of death. So although it can't be proved objectively, for that individual, hey, that's quite important. Now, even more subjectively, there are things like psychic circles, development circles, mediumship, things like that, where people say that they are in contact with beings from other realms. So things like automatic handwriting, that sort of thing. Where people are writing things down that they say is coming from someone from a different planet or from a different realm, but certainly not this scheme of things. Also, there's meditation. There's concentration. It's said that if you have sufficient skill in concentration, you can track back in your life. You can take it by the day and then the month and the year. Go back all the way to your own birth, remembering it, recalling it, go through the death process of the previous life and come back out, as it were, in the past life. This is remembering, yes. There's a very good account in Alan's teacher's book, and that's the Venerable Kapalawadu, Life of a Siamese Monk, where he explains vividly exactly what he did in order to recall a past life. So there is evidence, but it's pretty subjective. Now, this is an extraordinarily important subject for everyone. Everyone obviously goes through life and death. But what's important is the fact that the view that you take will impinge dramatically on your life. The views we hold condition the way we perceive life and the way we think. And vice versa, the way we think influences the way we perceive and the views that we hold. Also, the views condition the way we behave and the way we choose to communicate, the things that we feel it's important to put our energies into, what we want to concentrate on, what we choose to be mindful of, is dependent upon our views. So if you hold a one life view, that'll have repercussions, and if you hold a many life view, that too will have repercussions. Now, in terms of the Buddha's teaching, the doctrine of rebirth is an integral part of the Buddha's, well, what should we call it tonight? A system. I think we'll call it a system tonight. The Buddha's teaching is a system of mental development. It has one purpose and one purpose only. It's to bring people to the cessation of suffering. Yeah, that's the purpose of the system. So it's a system like a car is a system. A car gets you from here to Bath. So you need all the different aspects of that system to be in place in order for you to get from here to Bath in your car. Now, to get from a situation of suffering to reach the end of suffering, if you're using the Buddha's system, you have to have all the aspects of that system in place, which means you have to have the doctrine of rebirth in place in the system for it to work. If you don't have it in there, then the system won't work. Now, to back that statement up, I should say that at his enlightenment, the Buddha experienced three supernormal knowledges. He experienced his own past lives and gained knowledge of those. He experienced the arising and passing away of beings, seeing that they where they went on death was dependent upon the actions that they performed. And the third knowledge was that of what's called the destruction of the kankas, which is the supramundane knowledge, which is enlightenment. So these three knowledges form the nucleus of everything that the Buddha then did. And so the three are the law of rebirth, the law of kamma, and the transcendental teaching, the teaching that takes you beyond. And that's vital to remember, that the nucleus of the teaching involves all three parts, not just the supramundane, the transcendental bit. It also includes the rebirth and the kamma in the total system. If that's understood, then we're doing well. Now, he talked about the wheel of rebirth. So this is the teaching on kamma and many lives. And it states, quite simply, that we go from life to life to life, dependent on the actions that we perform. The actions that we perform that are largely selfish produce painful results. The actions that we perform that are relatively unselfish provide pleasant results. And so the sort of life that we can expect in the future is dependent upon the actions that we perform now. This is cutting a long story short, but essentially we go round the whirligig of samsara, the wheel of rebirth, endlessly performing actions that actually set up the conditions for a new life elsewhere. And this is perpetually going on. What we have to do in terms of the teaching is all about suffering and its cessation. It's coming to the end of suffering, reducing levels of suffering. So the purpose of his description of rebirth and kamma is to provide the means for us to reduce levels of suffering. And the purpose of his supramundane teaching, the destruction of the kankas, is to get us free from suffering completely, not a reduction, the complete elimination forever. And that is synonymous with coming off the wheel of rebirth. So it's the ending of the wheel of rebirth that is, you could say, that is enlightenment, going beyond that wheel. So rebirth is essential in terms of this teaching. Now there are two ways when people approach the teaching that they can take this doctrine of rebirth. They can come to it with an open mind or with a closed mind. It's entirely up to the individual. I want to give you an example of what I'd call a closed mind. And I want to reiterate here that there's no criticism of the individual. This is just wishing to explore the views that he may be holding. Not too long ago, we received an email from a student of philosophy who is currently studying for a PhD. And he wished to come along on a retreat to learn to meditate, to, in his words, attune the mind and improve his logical focus, which obviously would be vital for his work in philosophy. But that he was searching for a Buddhist retreat that was free from metaphysical and spiritual dross. He was hoping to learn a meditation technique that focuses entirely upon the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, the three marks. So essentially he was looking for vipassana meditation. But he was not concerned with puja, prayer, metempsychosis, the doctrine of reincarnation, or any other dogmatic aspect of the religion. Now that's fair enough. He has his own reasons for doing it, but obviously we couldn't allow him to come on retreat here, because for us the doctrine of what we call rebirth is intrinsic to understanding the whole system of mental development. In terms of somebody wanting to come along to learn about the Buddha's teaching, what he displayed was a classic closed mind. There was complete assurance on his part about what was important and what wasn't important. He already understood what it was that he wanted. And other aspects of the teaching that didn't fit into that were put to one side. It's a classic instance of a closed mind. If someone comes to the teaching with that idea that rebirth is simply a dogmatic, superstitious, medieval doctrine that should have been let go of years ago, and yet still wants to practice vipassana, then really they're taking the bits they like, not taking the whole system, and it's not actually going to work very well. There is another approach. It's an open mind. There was a traveller in India. He'd reached a certain town and he met another traveller there who said he'd been to see a guru. There was nothing particularly fabulous about this, because you get to meet gurus all over the place. But this guru apparently was an astrological guru. He was a professor of astrology. And when our traveller heard this, he kind of poo-pooed the idea. That's ridiculous. Who ever heard of such a thing? Astrology, that's ridiculous. The person that had been to see him says, have you ever actually gone for a reading? And our traveller said, well, no, I've never actually explored it. He said, well, you're displaying a bit of a closed mind there, aren't you? Assuming you know without going to check. And our traveller pondered that point and said, well, you're right, actually. I should really go and check it out. So he did. He went along to see this professor of astrology. And he gave him his details, you know, time of birth, that sort of thing. Came back the next day. And he was shocked, actually, by how accurate that astrological reading was. At the time, he told him how many girlfriends he'd had, the state of his relationship with his parents. This is information he couldn't possibly have. There was a lot in there that he thought was really very good, and it changed his outlook. His outlook then had to include the possibility, at least, that astrology had something going for it. And in fact, looking back 10 years later, a lot of what the astrologer predicted did actually come to pass. In, I'd have to say, quite vivid detail, very accurate. And so for that particular person, their attitude towards astrology completely changed. But it was the openness of his mind, the willingness to take on board what the professor had to say, the whole issue of astrology. Crikey, is that the time? Already on the second page, right. You're being very patient. I'll get to the point in a minute. Okay, so let's look at the One Life view. But I want us to look at it in terms of what leads, does it lead to a reduction in suffering? Then it's in context. So if there's the openness to look at this, then it may reveal things. Firstly, is the idea that the One Life view is the modern idea, it's the modern rational scientific idea. If you read the Pali Canon, you'll find that there are numerous references to the Buddha actually meeting different wanderers, different philosophers who expounded a One Life view. And the Buddha would talk to them and try and explain his view. So the idea that the One Life view is the modern rational approach, really it doesn't hold water. Since the beginning of time, people have held all sorts of different views. For someone holding the One Life view, existence amounts to no more than 80 years. The whole of subjective experience, there's nothing before it, there's nothing after it. So the motto is one life, live it. Make the most of it. It's the only chance you've got. Now there's a time pressure involved here. You've only got 80 years, 90 years maybe. So there's an underlying sense of being behind schedule a lot of the time. I know as a young man I felt that very strongly. And coupled with that, there's a fear of failure. Because you've only got one bite at the cherry. If you don't fulfill your dream, that's it. There's nothing else. Moreover, someone with this view will consider that life is unfair. Why should it be that some people are born rich, other people born poor, some people are born with disabilities, others seem to strike lucky all the time? Where's the fairness in it all? Not only that, of course, whether you act like a saint or whether you act as a mad dictator, at the end all there is death, and neither one is better. My reason for saying that is because if you don't hold the view of rebirth, then your actions don't have results. See, because there's no after this life, so the how to put it, the actions you perform in this life will not bring about results after you die. Therefore, action and result is kind of broken. Now, this can actually have quite a good knock-on effect, that it can heighten social conscience. So the rationalist will want to change the world for the better, so he'll try and improve things for people who are worse off, which I agree is a worthwhile thing to do. Of course, the subject of death, well, there's different ways of taking it. Some people who hold the one life view won't want to talk about it at all. Thoughts of dying will be suppressed. The subject will never be looked at because obviously it represents an absolute end. Some will see that death as being peaceful, actually. But they still have difficulty in that even though they believe that it will be peaceful, they don't actually know that. And so there will be a subtle fear, a subtle doubt lurking, even though that they hope it will be peaceful. They may believe sincerely that it's peaceful, but they don't know. And that's a very important difference. So if there's no life after this one, is there any reason for spiritual practices? Why bother? What's the incentive? As an illustration, I once interviewed someone on retreat. We're getting on very well, but at the end he said to me, though, what's the point of me practicing if I'm not going to become enlightened in my lifetime? What's the point? At the time I was still a bit green. I kind of gave a faffy answer. It was only in hindsight that I think, oh, he's got a one life view. We could have talked about it, because the Buddha definitely states that on the road to enlightenment there are definite stages that you reach: stream winner, once returner, non-returner, and arahant. The stream winner has no more than 7 lives further. We're coming back to this scheme of things. The once returner, as the name suggests, only has to come back once. The non-returner, as the name suggests, doesn't have to come back. So clearly, it's worthwhile if you take on the more than one life view. But if you don't, and you don't think that actions have results, then there isn't too much incentive there to practice. The one life view also fosters clinging to life. My name is really me. My body is really me. And at the end of life, it's cut off completely. There's nothing more that remains. So there's clinging to what the Buddha called the 5 aggregates. And sometimes for someone who has a one life view, the actual death process can be somewhat arduous, because they just don't want to give up. They don't want to let go. Whereas letting go seems to be the most sensible thing to do. So that's the one life view. As for the rebirth view, if holding that view, what kind of thoughts does it promote? What kind of actions does it promote? Henry Ford, the US car pioneer, said this: I adopted the theory of reincarnation when I was 26. Work is futile if we cannot utilize the experience we collect in one life in the next. When I discovered reincarnation, it was as if I had found a universal plan. I realized that there was a chance to work out my ideas. Time was no longer limited. I was no longer a slave to the hands of the clock. He goes on, genius is experience. Some seem to think that it is a gift or talent, but it is the fruit of long experience in many lives. The discovery of reincarnation put my mind at ease. I would like to communicate to others the calmness that long view of life gives to us. Which essentially sums up everything I wanted to say. Life is fair when you include that your actions have results. What we experience in the way of pleasure and pain and gain and loss, etc., can be seen to be due to our own actions. Well, an easy example of that would be, say, somebody who repeatedly steals and ends up in prison as a consequence. Eventually they get found out and they have to experience the results of their actions. Also consider Sherry Lee Laird's quote about the chance to correct mistakes. In her example, if it's true, if what she's saying is correct, then a being experienced a very painful death that included an awful lot of remorse and a feeling that she'd done the wrong thing. And in this life, she repeatedly experienced those same sort of thoughts, those same sort of feelings, even that same sort of materiality as well, the crushing pains in the chest. And that she had to work through it. Eventually, she had to reach the point where she could actually accept what was happening. So she was no longer pushing it away. Once she was able to accept it, she had a story, she had a description that she could use. This is Marilyn Monroe. This was her death experience. Oh, right. So all I have to do is accept that that was the case and let go of it. And when anyone lets go of those kinds of experiences, they feel the better for it, of course. And I'm sure there are occasions we all know in our own lives where there are things that we find difficult to let go of. And they may have been plaguing us since childhood. Now, one of the problems of a more than one life view is it can tend towards indolence and indifference. I think what happens is that people make the mistake of not including the fact that their present actions are going to have results. And they mistake karma to mean a sort of kind of fate or predestination. So there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to accept things. I suspect that that's one of the reasons why the rationalists are so hard on people who believe in reincarnation. Because they see that they just don't do anything to help. So that's one of the problems. If you don't have a proper understanding of karma upaka, action and result, then you can fall into that error. Now there's the fear of the future can arise with a more than one life view. Oh, I've been bad in the past. And whatever is going to come of it, I'll have to experience a painful rebirth, that sort of thing. And it can produce fear in some people. But if somebody undertakes spiritual practices, then they can erect the most enormous cushion effect in their lives. If, say, there's something you did in the past that was a bit bad, and you know it was, and you know you're going to experience the results. If, however, you have decided to undertake spiritual practices, like, for instance, loving kindness or generosity, coming along to the centre to help out, or the myriad ways. Keeping the precepts is a classic example. If you keep the precepts impeccably, you find that when you do experience the results, they don't impinge with anything like the same force than if you weren't living by the precepts. Yeah. The Buddha explained it as the same as putting a grain of salt in a cup full of water. Well, one grain makes it undrinkable. But if you put that same grain of salt in a freshwater lake, does it make it undrinkable? No, of course not. It's because it's insignificant by comparison. So if anyone is slightly worried by the fear of future painful results, then spiritual practices make sense because life goes on. So what comes next depends a lot on what we do now. So that's looking at rebirth in terms of the conventional world, the world of beings, the world of you, me, and how we interact. There's so much that can actually be done with a view of more than one life. But rebirth is also essential to supramundane wisdom. In fact, they dovetail perfectly. If we just restate the Buddha's three supernormal knowledges, it was rebirth, karma, actions have results, and enlightenment, the enlightenment teaching which takes you beyond the world of rebirth. And to practice, to understand this, we practice vipassana meditation. And when we look at vipassana meditation, instead of looking at the world in a conventional sense, we look at it in an ultimate sense. We look at what the Buddha called the five aggregates. That's materiality, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, and consciousness. If you look carefully at anything you... I'll give you an example, one I heard today. Apple pie. If you take an apple pie to bits and actually observe what an apple pie actually consists of in the ultimate sense, you will find shape and colour. You will find which is shape and colour, which is the materiality, taste, materiality. Apple pie, the concept, is a perception that is applied. You'll find in that experience pleasant feeling, the thought of eating the pie. The actual experience of eating the pie produces pleasant feelings. There will be mental formations in regard to the eating of the apple pie. For instance, I wish I could have another one, craving. And of course, there is the knowing of the entire experience in all its little bits, which is consciousness. So seeing, tasting. Now when we look carefully at our experience, we find that all those aggregates are in a state of constant disintegration, is the best way of putting it. Those five aggregates arise and pass away. They don't have any continuity. They don't last. The actual apple pie is a mere collection of these five aggregates. It doesn't have any inherent existence at the ultimate level, that you will only find these five aggregates. Now this is extremely important to understand this. What drives the wheel of rebirth? The Buddha said that it's the thirst for life that drives the wheel of rebirth. It's the wanting an apple pie today, it's wanting an apple pie tomorrow, it's wanting an apple pie in the future. Wanting anything, craving for anything, generates an intense thirst, a longing for sights, sounds, tastes, touches, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. What it is at the ultimate level, what it is we want from life at the ultimate level is more five aggregate experience. But the importance of vipassana is that through observation of these aggregates, you see that they arise and pass away. Consequently, they don't have the satisfaction. They don't have they don't produce the satisfaction that we believe that they should, because they arise and pass away. Now that's very important, because the more you see that, the more you begin to see experientially, not according to any theory, but experientially, you see that whatever you get in the future will be the same. It will be five aggregate experience, and it will therefore arise and pass away, whatever it is, at the ultimate level. Now because we don't understand this, we believe that it is possible to find complete lasting satisfaction through worldly things. And so we put in actions in order to try and get those things. But we never get there. Because you find that no matter what situation you actually find yourself in, in whatever way you're able to manipulate those five aggregates, looking at it at the ultimate level, they will still arise and pass away. And so we find that we're on this treadmill of always trying to find satisfaction from things that cannot provide satisfaction. And it's only the ignorance of that that is the problem. But that it's that those actions that drive us into a rebirth. Yeah. It's the thirst. You think about it. In order to experience anything, an apple pie, you have to have an eye, you have to have an ear, you have to have a nose, a tongue. You have to have material support for the arising of mind. You have to have mind and body in order to have sense bases. Only then can you experience sensory contact and therefore experience perceptions and feelings. And as the more you look in Vipassana, the more you find that it really is like that. All you can see is the arising and passing away of mental and physical phenomena. And you begin to realize that that's all you ever will experience. There will never be anything else at the ultimate level. And so you begin to let go of that craving. And as you let go of the craving, of course, you don't suffer because you're no longer looking for the satisfaction. I'm going to do a big, big jump here. Enlightenment is the complete realization that there's no separation in any experience, that all experience is seamless, it's undivided, it's a completely non-separate reality. It's the best way of putting it. The more and more you see these aggregates arising and passing away, and the more you see that it's your actions that are perpetuating the round, and the more you let go, eventually you reach a point where you no longer there's no longer any action going on with those five aggregates. You're not trying to manipulate them at all. You simply just watch them without any manipulation whatsoever. That's the culmination of the practice. Is you just in the end, there is just those five aggregates happening over and over again. And then magically the penny drops. All of a sudden you see that there are just these aggregates arising and passing away. And then there is a mental concept, a mental construction that goes on, which then separates that indivisible reality. It separates things out into me, the world, the chair, the clock, the light, you, me. You see that it's just purely just a mental construction. It's something the mind does. It has no intrinsic reality. At that point, the realization is that there is no world other than as a mental construction. And all the things that we think are real are in fact just the mere shadow of reality. Kind of mind-blowing. Because what it does, in that instant, it takes you beyond that wheel of rebirth, that forever trying to... I've got an example. I saw Queen's Park Rangers play Tottenham in the early 90s. I think it might have been 1990 actually, and Paul Gascoigne was playing for Tottenham. And, you know, he's a bit of a clown for people who know their football. And he had this trick. When he was warming up, he would run up to a ball, but just as he was just about to pick it up, he would just kick it with his foot. And so it would just roll on. And so then he'd have to run to the ball. And just as he was about to pick it up, he'd kick it. But he did it so beautifully that you couldn't see the seam. So it just looked like he was forever trying to pick up this ball, but it was forever just being kicked a bit further ahead. That's samsara. That's the wheel of rebirth right there. Thank you, Paul Gascoigne. Enlightenment is simply just to realize that you just don't have to keep on kicking the ball. You can. It's It's the realization that every moment is complete. And so you don't have, there is no ball actually to pick up, other than in the most loose, conventional terms. And therefore you find that the mind is just blissfully peaceful, because the fear of birth and death has been completely eliminated. Because you see that birth and death only relate to these things that the mind has separated out. It's only the birth and death of ideas, of descriptions. They're not ultimately real. And of course, you can't get there intellectually. You can't get there any other way than sitting down, looking at your experience, free from any bias, any judgment about what you're looking at. And it's, I would say that if you pick up this system and you choose to use this system to try and find the answer, then you will not do it without being open-minded about the whole nature of rebirth, the whole doctrine of rebirth. Because quite simply, if you put it in terms of this teaching, then enlightenment is going beyond rebirth. It's as simple as that. So if someone is truly interested in finding the answer, then they just simply have to be open-minded towards the idea of rebirth at the conventional level, then the ultimate level, and work with it, explore it, think about it. Oh dear, time to go home. Thank you.